Hi, I'm Steve Goldstein, and this is the Friday Newscap podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode.
It's not an ad that I would have done, but in this case, if you look at her record, she has a dangerous record on security issues. So we'd ask people to look at the record and to pay attention to the contrast that they have.
DC has a double-digit lead over Garcia in the Arizona governor's race. He's dominating the vote with a 17-point lead over his Democratic opponent, Garcia.
As prosecutors, we enforce the law. If you don't like the law, you run for governor, you run for the legislature, or you run for Congress.
All those lawyers did their interpretation to say, well, these dreamers that have DACA, actually, yeah, they fit now. That's not who the voters were talking about. I agree with that. I would not have litigated that case.
Carolyn Warner was a powerful force, a powerful voice for education in Arizona throughout a number of decades.
And with us to talk about Arizona's U.S. Senate and gubernatorial races, some new polls on Arizona's U.S. Senate and governor races, along with this week's attorney general debate and more, are Emily Ryan of Copper State Consulting and attorney and former congressional staffer Roy Herrera. Guys, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you
for having us.
So, Roy, apocalypse if Kyrsten Sinema is elected senator. What do you make of that mailer?
Well, it's a very aggressive mailer, right? I mean, I don't think I've really seen anything like that. I mean, for people who haven't seen it, it literally has a nuclear bomb going off in downtown Phoenix. I'd like to believe that both sides wouldn't be accusing the other side of potentially creating some nuclear apocalypse in our community. So I think it's a sign of the times. I mean, we're getting closer and closer. Ballots are dropping. We're getting closer and closer to the election. The Senate race is extremely close. Increasingly, you see outside groups becoming more aggressive and more negative in their advertising, and that is reflected in this ad. But it's pretty aggressive for me.
Emily, Independent Expenditure Group paid for this ad, right. But does that indicate anything to us that there is desperation, or as Roy said, it's just we're coming down to it, we need to get early ballots are out, whatnot?
I don't think it's desperation. I think that it is such a close race. You could see this kind of thing out of either side's supporters. You know, the numbers are so tight. They're doing anything they can to try to pull Kyrsten Sinema's numbers down a little bit and get their message across.
What message are they trying to get across with this? I mean, I assume they're not expecting voters to take this literally, that if Kyrsten Sinema wins, somebody will drop a nuclear bomb on Phoenix. So what are they trying to get voters to think when they see this?
They're trying to get voters to think Sinema bad. Just bad. I don't think it's a literal message. I think it's just bad feelings. This is bad. This is serious. And, you know, as much as we all complain about the tone of negative ads and how sick we are of it, everyone you see says, I'm sick of these negative ads. They work. That's why people do them.
Negative ads work, but I think this one's so over the top that there might be some sort of negative backlash to it. I mean, the ironic thing about all this is that Congresswoman Sinema voted for the McCain Defense Reauthorization Bill. I mean, she's been generally pretty strong on national security issues. So to hit her on this particular issue, I think, is a little not only over the top, but probably is factually incorrect.
Emily, how much of this is ultimately sort of psychological warfare? This idea that it seems like you're talking about negative ads working, almost seems like they work because there's not as much optimism as there should be just in general. We're always sort of living on the edge of fear, and fear seems to work on us as human beings. But is that too cynical to say?
I don't think it's too cynical, but I don't think it's a new phenomenon. I think we've seen negative campaigning just less sophisticated in decades past. But it's designed to trigger an emotion that motivates you to show up and vote. That's what it's all about.
And we're certainly seeing the negative advertising in the governor's race, too. And I think that's had some significant influence on the polling numbers there. And I'm sure we'll get into that in a little bit. But negative advertising does work. I think you're seeing it on both sides. I mean, obviously, Democrats do it, too. This one in particular, I just struck me as being a bit ridiculous. But it's not like it's going to stop in the next 3 weeks.
When we talked about, Steve mentioned that an outside group paid for putting a hologram on a mailer. I don't know how many mailers they sent out, but can't have been inexpensive to do, and this is pretty interesting. And it's not just printing something on cardstock. I would imagine that indicates that the group that sent this out is really, really serious and desperately wants to get this particular message out.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think so too. I'm sort of upset I didn't get one,
but might be a collector's item.
It might be a collector's item. Yeah. No, I think you make a great point. I mean, they really the time is running out of the hourglass. The sand's running out, and now's the time to do it. They're pulling out all the stops.
I mean, this is one of the most important races in the country if we think about Senate control and what's going to happen. And so both sides have been spending, you know, literally tens of millions of dollars on this race. I mean, the independent group that I believe is behind that mailer has already spent, I think, at least $10 million in this race. So, you know, there's a vendor out there who made that very fancy hologram that also made a lot of money off of it. But again, I mean, we're just seeing an increase in interest in this race and money at levels we've never seen before. I mean, just look at Congresswoman Sinema's last campaign finance report. I mean, $7 million in one quarter. I've never seen that before in the state of Arizona.
Let's stick on the negative aspect of things, because we've seen negativity, Roy, when it comes to Kyrsten Sinema, when it comes to old videos of her or the pink tutu, and those are things in her past. There's very little related to what she's actually done in Congress. Whereas Martha McSally, a lot of the criticism is she's a liar, she's lying in these ads. Do you think there's any depth there in terms of we're going to see anything related to Martha McSally's career prior to this? Because, again, it seems like we're seeing what did Kyrsten Sinema do 7 or 8 years ago, and what did Martha McSally do in this campaign?
Well, I think if you compare their congressional careers, I mean, you're seeing, you know, Congresswoman Sinema with her caucus being seen as a pretty moderate, you know, blue dog Democrat. I mean, she's focused on sort of bread and butter issues while she's been in Congress. You know, with McSally, you know, a lot of the attacks on her have been related to things that she's done recently, primarily, you know, her support and her closeness to Donald Trump. Mm. And I think both sides are just looking at each other and saying, okay, what are the sort of best attacks we have on that person in going there? Obviously, I think the best attacks the Republicans see are on things that Congresswoman Sinema did before she even got to Congress, because I think they don't want to talk about her record in Congress, which is generally very good.
Emily, does it matter if Kyrsten Sinema said something in 2011 about crazy Republicans? Because that was a time when Sheriff Arpaio was still in office, Russell Pierce still had some power, and there may have been many people who would have agreed with her then who might say, wait a second, that's not our party now, but there's Donald Trump too. So it mm-hmm. seems like, does the 2011, is it relevant, do you think, in this campaign?
I think it's very relevant. And the reason I think it's relevant is the way Kyrsten has modeled herself and run this race. They're both trying to grab up that independent middle-of-the-road voter. Kyrsten cannot win a statewide race without some Republicans. You can't do it on Democratic votes alone. So she's got to make them feel like she's an independent Barry Goldwater Arizonan, and these shatter that image. And it's no longer, oh, McSally shouldn't be so negative. These are damaging to Kyrsten because it's her own voice. It's her own voice calling those voters she's courting crazy.
I mean, I agree with that. Are damaging, Roy?
Well, I mean, I agree with what you said about, you know, how you win here, right? I mean, I think the reality is, as a Democrat, you do need to have some Republican support. You certainly need to do very well with independents, right? And so, you know, McSally is making these kinds of attacks because she thinks that these attacks are going to hurt her with those kinds of voters. I think, you know, conversely, Congresswoman Sinema's campaign is going to be focused again on, you know, reducing health care costs, you know, helping our seniors, helping our veterans, because those are the kinds of issues that those people in the middle really care about.
Yeah. Well, Emily, are Republicans in this race then trying to almost peg this as the comment Hillary Clinton about the deplorables? And that's, is it that a parallel, that kind of thing?
I think so. I think this is Sinema's deplorable moment where it's see, I told you so. I told you she wasn't a moderate. You know, this, and what's interesting is Sinema in her congressional seat has never really had a difficult race. You know, she's sort of walked into that. Can anyone even name her Republican challengers for that congressional seat? You know, she's just owned that space and been able to sort of straddle that line and build for this moment. Now you're seeing Republicans and what would, you know, Republicans catch on to the real Kyrsten. But what's probably worrisome for them is, are Democrats frustrated with her moderate approach? Are they going to be unmotivated to show up and vote for her because she's not carrying the flag? And maybe that's why Bernie Sanders has been out lately.
Well, I don't think Bernie Sanders is going to be with Congresswoman Sinema while he's here. But to your point, I mean, there has been some criticism of her on the progressive side. I think that ultimately is a bit overstated, particularly when on the Democratic side and the progressive side, we recognize what's at stake here, right? I mean, at the end of the day, you know, getting this Senate seat would be a historic moment for Democrats here, and certainly, again, has national implications, because the only way for Democrats to take back the U.S. Senate is to win here.
So the two of them will meet in their only debate early next week. I'm wondering what the odds are that we hear something from either of them that we have not heard before, either in a stump speech or in a line of attack in a campaign commercial. Roy, are you expecting anything new to come out of this? Are you expecting them to actually, like, fist fight with each other? I mean, given the tone of the race so far?
If there's going to be anything surprising, I think it would actually happen from the McSally side. I think these, sort of, if you look at the average of the polling right now, I mean, there's been one outlier recently, but you know, the other seven most recent polls has Sinema up. And I think the average has her up by 2 or 3 points. I think that's probably the reality and state of the race right now. So usually when you get into a debate, you have somebody who's down a bit when you're close to the election. That person ends up being the aggressor. So if someone's going to be the aggressor, I think it's going to be McSally here. And that would, you know, lead to maybe some attacks that we haven't seen before. Overall, though, they're both incredibly disciplined politicians. So at the end of the day, I really feel like they're going to be pretty scripted.
Emily, what do you think?
You know, I think what's interesting about this is normally if you have one female candidate and a man coming in, everyone's cautioning him, you know, don't be too aggressive. In this scenario, they can both be as aggressive as they want without having any misogynist allegations lodged at them. But, you know, I really think this debate, there's a lot that rides on it for Sinema, because she's been sort of MIA lately, and all we're getting is the controlled image being pushed out there. We've heard a lot more from McSally in the press. So people are waiting to hear Sinema answer and answer some direct questions on where she stands on policy issues. And I think there's a lot more hinging on this for her.
Do you anticipate that there will be actual substantive policy discussion at this event?
Well, I sure hope so. I think I don't know that I'd go so far as to anticipate that. But, you know, I do think that's what people are waiting to see. Like, okay, now I want to know, who are these two people? You know, tell me how you're going to vote on things.
And finally, before the break, Roy, let me start with you on this one. Does it matter that they both seem to be a little bit hesitant about debating? We know that Kyrsten Sinema did accept 3 debates, but then there was a little bit back and forth. McSally was very much not ready to commit except to that initial CNN one. Does it indicate to you anything about an extra level of nervousness about facing the other one-on-one?
I don't think so. I mean, I think there's been generally a downtick, let's say, in the amount of debates in a lot of the races, right? I mean, I think it's just become sort of in modern politics something that you're very cautious about doing. Generally, again, the person that wants to have the more debates or the most debates is the person that's losing. That's just, you know, sort of traditional. So in a tight race like this one, I think, you know, both sides are going to be extremely cautious about what they're agreeing to, how many, what's the format, where it's going to be, things like that. So it's not unusual to me.
Yeah, there's zero room for any error. The numbers are just so tight. So I agree with Roy. There's a lot of caution on both sides.
That's Emily Ryan. Also here is Roy Herrera with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. We're in the midst of the Friday newscap, which continues after this. Good morning. It's the Friday newscap here on 91.5 KJZZ with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Our guest this morning, Emily Ryan of Copper State Consulting, and attorney and former congressional staffer Roy Herrera. Emily, let's look at some recent polling. We have seen that Governor Ducey looked to increase his spread over challenger David Garcia. But now, based on a poll which may be an outlier, it seems that the governor has spread it even more. Is this a race? Has it ever been a race?
Oh, I think maybe early on there was a bit of a race, just in terms of the concern of a really strong Democratic turnout, like we saw in the primary. But it's not a race anymore. You know, Ducey's got this. Whatever poll you look at, I mean, if you're in the Garcia camp and you're in a position of arguing, no, I'm losing by slightly less than that amount, that's not a good place to be.
Yeah, Roy, David Garcia, people have criticized his campaigning to some extent, but also the governor's had much more money to spend. What would David Garcia have had to do to make this a very, very close race? Considering education is a big issue, we may see change in the legislature based on that, but it doesn't seem to have caught momentum for him.
Well, I think you pointed out the biggest factor here, which is, and we talked earlier about the power of negative advertising, and I think we saw that here. I mean, when you have $15 million dropped on your head and you really don't have any money to respond to that, there's going to be changes in your polling numbers. So, you know, what he could have done differently or what would have been a better situation for the Democratic nominee would be to have more money, like anything else. That would have been a big deal. But like you said, I mean, education, you know, seemingly is a huge issue here. I think, you know, the governor has done, you know, tried to blunt that a bit with the 20 by 20 thing. And obviously, InvestNet not being in the ballot, I think, also hurt a lot, too. So, you know, it hasn't quite quite taken off. But as far as the polling goes, I mean, the poll I think you're referencing is an outlier in the sense that it's
as far as how large the spread is.
Exactly. Yeah. As far as how large the spread is, you know, the internal polling has it more in the, as they released, in the high single digits. You know, things can change. I mean, we're 3 weeks out. You know, I've seen leads evaporate before. I'm not saying it's likely, but it's possible. And to your point, I mean, we don't know what the Democratic surge is going to be like, if there is going to be one. I think there will be one, but it's more a question of, like, how big is it and how does it affect things?
Roy, at the risk of doing a post-mortem on a campaign and a candidate before a vote has actually been counted, there's been a lot written and discussed about sort of the differences between how David Garcia campaigned 4 years ago when he ran for superintendent of public instruction and cast himself as sort of a moderate, and this time when he's been campaigning with Bernie Sanders and talked about endorsements from Elizabeth Warren. From a Democratic perspective, has he changed sort of the image of where he is sort of on the political spectrum this year relative to 4 years ago?
Well, it's not quite apples to apples, right? I mean, running for superintendent is a sort of a different role when you're running for governor, and there's a lot of other issues. And then we're also in the era of Donald Trump, and I think that sort of changes things. Has he run more to the left and more progressive than he did in 2014? I think absolutely. I think you look at his policy positions, and that has to be the case. But also, you know, if the theory, again, is that you want to drive progressive turnout, drive Latino turnout, for example, then I think a lot of the positions, I think, are based on that presumption, that if you take those positions, you're going to drive those kinds of voters out.
But again, you can't win a statewide race in Arizona without Republican voters. And as Republicans, we were all waiting for David Garcia to pivot, scoot, inch slightly towards the right and give us something. Never happened.
You know, another thing about the advertising that has struck me as interesting is that though the governor has gotten tremendous amounts of money from IE group, I mean, independent expenditure groups he's not connected to, but that have supported him or his point of view, those have been very, very negative toward David Garcia. But the governor's own ads are the ones we're seeing are very positive. It's almost like Morning in America. What about that contrast? It's quite interesting. Do you think voters can delineate between those two?
I don't think so. I think when you're watching the commercials, it just all seems like the same thing. You're just hearing from the campaign. Very few people read that fine print at the end of it. But I think candidates are very careful to not be saddled with the negative campaigning. You know, that's why you count and hope that the IEs will come in and do it.
So big political science philosophy question then. Do candidates like the, I mean, do they think to themselves, boy, I really, really wouldn't have done that ad, but gosh darn it, I'm really glad they did that for me? Or do they think that's casting me in a strange light too?
I think the former, okay. Right? You know, because at the end of the day,
I'm so naive, I mean, Roy.
Well, or I'm too cynical. I don't know, but you know, candidates want to win ultimately, right? I mean, that's the number one goal. And you know, if they can get an outside group to do the negative work for them, so they're not directly tied to it, I think that has a great, you know, benefit to them, where they can focus on perhaps their issues, on the positive, the, you know, the setting the agenda for themselves and not having to go negative. That's always a good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, if you want someone to be able to throw a punch for you so that you don't have to do it yourself. And all these people that embark on this ultimately want to win. So it's whatever it takes.
We've talked about a couple of debates today. Let's talk about one that happened this week between the two candidates for Attorney General, Republican Mark Brnovich, the incumbent, and the Democratic challenger, January Contreras. This is one that seemingly based on the polls, and of course, who knows anymore if polls are accurate, but the polls have shown this not to be a terribly close race. Did we learn anything from the AG debate that was held this week, Emily?
Yeah, we sure did. We learned that January Contreras will not defend Arizona law if she disagrees with it or finds it to be unconstitutional. She's not going to leave that to the courts to decide. She's going to decide and recuse herself and have Arizona hire someone else to step in. And can you imagine if a sheriff decided to make arrests based on what laws he agreed with? I mean, it shows a fundamental either lack of understanding for the position or an inability to execute the position. But it was amazing to hear that in the closing minutes of that debate.
Roy, what do you think?
Well, what you're talking about is, I think, a difference of opinion about the lawsuit related to in-state tuition for Dreamers. You know, January's position is that, you know, Dreamers should get in-state tuition, and that's her interpretation of the law. I think another thing that was a big point of contention related to the Clean Energy Initiative and the Attorney General's position or involvement in the ballot description for that initiative. You know, obviously there's been a reaction to that from the clean energy folks because they've committed to spending over $3 million to help her. And so I think there are some significant, you know, developments that came out of that because now, you know, she might be the most well-funded as far as outside money of all the statewide candidates. Whether that's going to work or not, we'll see, but she'll have that money.
Yeah, and any time you see an out-of-state billionaire dump millions of dollars to target our top law enforcement officer in the state, that should get voters' attention. And I thought Brnovich, aside from that, I thought he handled himself very well in the debate. In fact, I think that's who we're looking at as a 2022 gubernatorial candidate. I mean, he really showed well.
That wouldn't be a surprise either. So January Contreras, first big run for office as Attorney General. I mean, Roy, does she have a future if she ends up losing by a lot in this race? Has she impressed you in any way that she's someone that could do something in the future here in Arizona?
Yeah, I mean, I hope she wins, obviously. Right. But if she doesn't, you know, she's a very impressive person. I've known her for years. I mean, she's got a tremendous history, resume, from working with Janet Napolitano to, you know, forming a nonprofit. Certainly, you know, going forward, if she were to lose this race, I hope she runs for something else.
Based on what Emily said, is Brnovich someone, if he were to win again, is he sort of an obvious candidate looking ahead? Obviously, not knowing what may happen in the next couple of years, we don't know, you know, what goes on. Is he a prime name, though, coming up as far as the Democrats need to think about going against Republicans in the future?
Certainly. I mean, I think if you look at the 2022 gubernatorial race, which will be, you know, potentially a completely open seat if Ducey were to win re-election, you know, there's going to be a lot of people that are going to look at it. But if you've got a popular attorney general running, that's certainly going to catch a lot of attention. And there's going to be a lot of people, I think, going to be running. I'm personally hoping that Secretary of State Katie Hobbs might think about it in 2022 if she wins this year. So.
So one last race we want to talk about is the 2nd Congressional District in Southern Arizona. We learned this week that the National Republican Congressional Committee is pulling its advertising from that race. This is the Ann Kirkpatrick versus Leah Marquez Peterson. Martha McSally is the current occupant of that seat. Emily, any surprise that the NRCC is basically – I mean, is this a sign that they're sort of waving the white flag here?
It is, unfortunately, for my party. They're packing up their toys and going home. You know, at the risk of revealing family secrets, you know, it's sort of viewed that Marquez Peterson hasn't put the work into it that people wanted to see. You know, it's kind of a lackluster race in general. You know, Kirkpatrick, this is her 3rd district in 4 years. Obviously, someone who just wants to be in office. You know, it's sort of one of those situations where there's not great choices, but I think they just decided they're not going to waste any money there, and they're going to focus those resources elsewhere.
What do you think, Roy?
I think that's right. I mean, if there's one thing that I think I'm fairly confident in, you know, when it comes to this year's election, is that I think Democrats are going to take back the House of Representatives. I feel pretty confident about that because there are so many districts across the country that Republicans are defending now, a lot of them in districts that Hillary Clinton won. And I think right now they're just trying to save their majority the best they can. And so they only have a limited amount of resources. They're going to redeploy them elsewhere because I think they see CD2 as lost.
Now, Roy, finally, when it comes to Ann Kirkpatrick, she's won, she's lost. Obviously, we've seen that in different districts. We saw it in the U.S. Senate race. Are we to a point now where voters in that district are thinking to themselves, okay, this is at least someone who I know knows her way around Washington? How important is that now, especially when we're in an age when it almost feels like another throw-the-bums-out sort of period?
Well, I think some voters put a lot of value into that, right? I mean, one of the things we have to think about here when this election is all over is, you know, the seniority that our legislators are going to have in Washington. I mean, we've had giants that have represented us in D.C. Pass. And at this point, for example, we don't have anybody on appropriations. We don't have, you know, people in seniority in their party. And I think having some experienced hands only helps our state. And that goes for both sides.
That's attorney and former congressional staffer Roy Herrera. Also with us, Emily Ryan of Copper State Consulting. Guys, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Friday Newscap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's big stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at the show@kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein, and thanks for listening.